from KQED.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Often immigrant parents will say they came to America to give their children a better life. And it's an explanation rarely questioned. But Aarti Shahani did question it and ended up learning things about her parents she never knew. They were refugees in Morocco, displaced by the partition of India. And they met in Casablanca, where Aarti and her two older siblings were born. Then immigrating to Queens, New York, the Shahanis would try to eke out the American dream, and they would come close. Shahani's father was able to open a successful electronics business, but it would later collapse after her father was arrested and sentenced to 8 months at Rikers Island. Aarti Shahani is an NPR correspondent covering Silicon Valley. It's great to have you on Forum, Aarti.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
I never knew this story about your family when you worked as a reporter here at KQED in like 2013 and 2014. Mm-hmm. But I think I understand why after reading your memoir. It sounded like for a long time you felt a need to make distance between your family's legal nightmare and the life and career that you were trying to build.
That's exactly it. I mean, like, it's so funny. I came into journalism in a very publicly facing career, really hiding myself. You know, I had the sense of, and your summary was fantastic. I was like, oh, I should learn to summarize from you, Mina. But I had this sense, you know, I was 16 years old when my father was first arrested. And I remember back then as a child, my first reaction was utter shame. I wanted to be a prosecutor when I grew up. My dad is at Rikers Island. And also, by the way, I was like a scholarship kid at a very fancy private school, learning for the first time, for example, what a country house is, like, you know, a house that is not your first home, which was to me crazy because the five of us, my family, grew up in a one-bedroom roach then. So as an immigrant kid trying to make my way through an elite world at a young age, already dealing with issues of not belonging, identity, that kind of thing, then dad's at Rikers and I'm like, what the hell? Like, why are you doing this to me? And what I trace through my book, and here we are in the memoir, is really how my understanding of both the justice system in the case and my own father ended up evolving. He was supposed to have an 8-month sentence, and it spiraled into a 14-year legal battle because deportation was tacked on as a second surprise punishment. I ended up fighting to keep my father here. I started fighting in earnest with all my heart and soul when I was 19. And I did not know I would be fighting until I was 30, which is, you know, I basically grew up in the shadow of that case. And so by the time you and I met, okay, at KQED, my credit score was crap. I was in my early 30s and really afraid of, do I have a future? Who am I when I'm not being an immigrant daughter? And so, you know, the amount of compartmentalizing that went on was, you know, I think really deep and also probably really common. Like, I'm sure that plenty of people have had this experience of who you are on the inside you feel you need to hide to survive in the outside.
Yes, it is this dual identity of the immigrant, though yours is pretty dramatic in the sense that your father was arrested and did have to stay at Rikers for so long. And it's clear that you had a very complicated relationship with him because even when you found out he was arrested, your thought was, what did you do, Dad, to get yourself into this mess? And I think you really tell well why you had that complicated relationship, because part of the reason that your family immigrated from Morocco to the U.S. in the first place was for your mother to escape a mother-in-law to some extent who could be deeply cruel to her.
Yeah. No, that's right. I mean, like, you know, I didn't know specifically why we came to America. And when mom and dad would say, we came here for a better life for you kids, you know, by the time part of me in writing Here We Are was frankly working through resentment and confusion because I was like, you know, my father has since passed. And this book is in large part a eulogy for him. I think he is one of these unsung heroes of low-end globalization who, you know, the kind of migrant, the kind of person who gets demonized categorically wherever he or she shows up, but is actually, you know, to me, a heroic figure. Mom, I'd asked her, I was like, Mom, what do you mean a better life for us kids? Well, like, we had a crappy life in a lot of ways. I'm like, what are you talking about better? And that's when she told me that my grandmother, her mother-in-law, you know, would throw plates at her if she didn't like what food was made, would require mom ask permission to open the refrigerator or leave the home, would not let my parents sleep in the same room, that my father had to stay in his mother's room and my mom had to sleep in the living room. My mom is one of the, if not the most resilient human being I know. I'm incredibly close to her. And so it shocked me when she told me that things had gotten so bad in this joint family relationship that she tried to take her own life. I have to tell you, as a journalist, we know this. As journalists, while we don't want humans to suffer, we know that suffering makes a great story. This, if it bleeds, it leads. Like, you know, there's a certain kind of, I've experienced this, moments of delight in these hard stories when they're from other people. When it's your own mother telling you about that, like my reaction was just like laid out, convulsing in tears, because this is a woman I love and admire for her strength. And so it, you know, the fact is we came to America because my mother was seeking freedom for herself and for her daughters. We've learned in school about how people were fleeing communism. We've learned far less about how women were fleeing controlling homes and patriarchy. But, you know, I've been on book tour now around the country, you know, a couple dozen stops. And what I have observed and learned from people coming to these events is, oh, that's my grandmother's story. Oh, I've heard a version of this story, you know. So I think that part of the tension we always had at home was that conflict between my father wanting to keep the old world and the old ways, like, Arthi, you belong in the kitchen. And my father would never have imagined that in America, a girl, his daughter, could be paid for using her mouth. I mean, that's wild. Like, where he didn't come from a universe where that was possible. But my mom saw that it was possible. And that conflict between the old and new world played out at home so hard.
Yes, which explained where your dad was when your mom was being treated this way, sort of what he was wrestling with. And also what you wrestled with in him in terms of growing up and him having these traditional views about you. I remember you writing a particularly poignant scene about him not standing up for you when your uncle basically was like, you know, don't. You should not speak. He didn't stand up for you even when he sort of threatened you in that moment. And so it created a lot of question marks.
Yeah. I mean, it was that moment, you know, it was actually really and here we are. I recount how my uncle, my dad's little brother who was running the store with him, he was a bully. OK, he had a really tough personality. Everyone in my family would agree about that's who he was. I think ultimately he was a very loyal family member, but he had that horrible kind of aggressive streak. And one day he'd ordered me to go to the kitchen. And I said, no, I didn't. I was like, they don't need my help. And he's like, go to the kitchen or I'll break your mouth. And just, it was so funny. And I think that this is really my American training. I just blurted out to him, lay a finger on me and I'll have you arrested. This is America. And that kind of conflict, I mean, that's really the spirit of the tension that was at home, you know. And then what's weird is how that tension ended up really transforming as we then had to fight together as a family to stay in this country.
Yes.
You know.
Right. You really were taking the lead in terms of being a voice for your parents. You were writing the judge in the case to try to get him to see it in another way. And he called you, the judge called you his pen pal. I mean, it did have some effect.
Yeah. No, I ended up, you know, my father and uncle were in this case together. And my uncle, who I thought of as a bully, I started to feel compassion for him because he was supposed to go to jail, like my father, for 8 months. And then because of a mistake by New York State, my uncle served 2.5 years. New York made a mistake. And to clear up that mistake, the lawyers, the adult lawyers, they weren't doing their job. So I started writing directly to the judge. And I was just like, you know, indignant. And how can you let a man linger in jail after he served more than his time? And, you know, and the judge, he actually responded. And he actually called all of the people, and the adults, into the courtroom and chastised them. And was like, I remember being in that courtroom. He's like, my pen pal there. And he pointed to me in the back benches. And I was like, yes, that's me. That's me. I'm his pen pal. Listen to us, you know. And so it's kind of funny because I grew up wanting to be a prosecutor. But my first foray into the legal system was the faux defender for my family.
Well, we should talk about why your dad was arrested.
Yes, yes. So my father and my uncle, they ran a wholesale electronics store. They sold watches and calculators in bulk, basically to anyone who would buy them. New York State came in and said that my father and uncle were money laundering for the Cali drug cartel. We went into court. That first court hearing, I remember it. I didn't tell anyone at my fancy school why I was missing class. And it was the people versus the Shahanis. We were no longer the people. And they basically made it sound like my family business was just a front for a cartel. We exist to clean dirty drug money. Now, here's the interesting thing about how these cases work. My father kept saying, I don't get it. We're just doing what everyone's doing. We're just doing what everyone's doing. And what he specifically was doing is he was selling electronics for cash. So instead of, for example, collecting people's – if you do transactions of a certain amount, basically you're supposed to collect paperwork on people, whatever, whatever. This not whatever, whatever. I mean, it's basically getting down the documentation for who your buyer is. Nobody in the industry did it because if you tried to do that, then the person would just go to the next store where they'd take your cash. Basically, my father was like, we're not a front for a cartel. We're just selling our electronics.
But yet his attorney, or the one that you could afford, right?
Well, the attorney we hired said, listen, Mr. Shahani, I hear you, but here's the thing. You can go to trial and you could get 10 years if convicted. And we were confused, like, wait, but they're offering us 8 months. Why would we get 10 years for trial? It's like, because of the trial penalty. If you exercise your constitutional right to trial, you get the trial penalty. So what do you want, Mr. Shahani? You want to do 10 years? You want to risk 10 years? Or you want to just do the 8 months and put it behind you? My father did what everybody, practically everybody listening to us right now would do. Take the plea. Statistically, that's just what people do. Now, we just didn't know that in exchange for that plea, even though he was a lawful permanent resident, he had a green card, and his family members were naturalized U.S. citizens, he would be, in a surprise second punishment, delegalized, actually under a relatively new set of laws passed, not under President Trump, but under Bill Clinton in the 1990s. So my father and my family, we basically got caught up in this case that, you know, and actually you'd mentioned the judge who became my pen pal. He's one of the people I interviewed for this book. We had a very unlikely and bizarre reunion. Now that I call my public radio life my fancy life. It's, you know, when Arthie got fancy. And because of this life, I ended up having friends in common with the judge who hit the gavel in my family's case. Like, I now roll in such a world that we have friends in common. LinkedIn tells me this. He and I have a reunion, and the first words out of his mouth were, your father and your uncle should never have taken that guilty plea. What a mistake. And me, I have to say, like, it felt like such a punch in the stomach. And his point to me was basically, listen, these cases, I'm analogizing now. This is not what he said. This is what I got from what he said. This is a game of poker. The justice system, it's not about innocence and guilt. It's about risk and reward. And you guys had a hand to play. You just didn't know how to play it.
We're talking with NPR correspondent Arthie Shahani. She was a toddler when her family migrated from Morocco to Queens to escape a dysfunctional extended family. And that began the Shahani's immigrant story. Her memoir is Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. And it follows the family's pursuit of green cards, her father's imprisonment on Rikers Island, and the long legal battle that followed for him not to be deported. What are your questions for Arthie Shahani? Are you an immigrant or a green card holder? What are you hearing in her story that is coming up for you, or maybe about family relationships or the way our nation or criminal justice system treats those who are vulnerable? The number 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, at KQED Forum, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. And that that time at Rikers, the battle to try to remain in the U.S., it took such a significant toll on your dad, his health, everything.
You know, my father, it's funny, while I've been on tour more than once, actually several times now, people have pointed out, you know, Arthi, it's funny because it's like the reason you got to know your dad is because he was locked up and you decided to visit him a lot. Like literally that's, you know, and this book, I mean, I feel like in part this book has been important for me to write at this moment because we are a nation of immigrants questioning how we treat the newcomer. And I want people to have a front row seat into the deportation system that my family saw. Just look at how it works. Come on in. But more importantly, it's a father-daughter story. How did dad, this guy I didn't like, the guy who just stood there while his little brother threatened to break my mouth, how did that guy become my best friend? Which he did.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, because you do write quite a bit about the sense of shame that you felt about your family. You even mentioned that you felt they were small time. you were in this one-bedroom roach-infested apartment. Then the electronics business does well. You get to move to Jersey to a four-bedroom home. And then you're like, I don't want to be branded a Jersey girl in front of all my elite prep school friends, which is, you know, such a middle and high school thing. And
a
you were only
crisis.
Able to go to this prep school because you got a full ride. I mean, This is a prep school that would cost, what, $50,000 a year now?
In today's terms, a Tesla a year to attend that school.
And so what was it like for you to go back and visit those emotions and struggle with them? Because it was clear that you did struggle with that sense of shame.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in terms of the process of memoir, it's interesting because people, you know, you want to bring yourself and your readers into the facts of what happened, but also the emotional journey. And I think that that's a sort of a key difference between when you're writing as a journalist and reporting versus when you're being you know, when you're going personal, it's like, how did things feel in the moment? And, you know, I can remember me as a kind of know-it-all, ambitious kid who's like, you know, I remember that in public school, I always wanted my parents to come to parent-teacher day because they'll just hear that their nerd girl is really nerdy. And then at private school, like, I did not want my parents to show up because all the other kids' parents were fancy and they were CEOs. That's where I learned what the term CEO was. They had country houses. They had PhDs. They had all these things that I didn't even know existed. And, you know, I didn't mind stepping into it and kind of, you know, talking through the young Arthi and making fun of her in certain ways because, you know, we all go through those phases. There's nothing to be ashamed about in it. And I just think that it's like, it's part of life's journey, you know?
Well, let's go to some calls and Jill in San Jose join us.
Oh, hi. I just had a quick question or concern, really. You mentioned that there was the 8-month possibility doing time versus going to trial and that there was a trial penalty. And, you know, as somebody who really values the Bill of Rights, my understanding is that, you know, we all have a right to a fair trial by a jury of our peers. And I am blown away by hearing this idea of a trial penalty. Can you explain a little bit more about, I don't know, that disparity between 8 months and going to trial and there possibly being an 8-10 years? That just blew my mind away.
Yeah, I mean, ditto, it blew our minds away, too. You know, if you look at it, the criminal justice system, the way that it processes the volume of cases it has, is basically through guilty pleas. So you get an indictment with the sort of the largest charges that the prosecution has to put on paper. And then you start whittling and negotiating your way down to what you are going to agree upon. Because if you go to trial, you will be hit with a stiffer sentence. That's how the system is structured. That part is not in our Bill of Rights, but it's practically how it works. And it stunned my family just as it's stunning you.
Jill, thanks for the question. And you were talking about how through the process of your dad being imprisoned and going through the legal battle together, that he became your best friend. And I was struck by what you described as a working definition of love, which was where passion meets duty. Mm. And it seems like through that you were able to channel what you felt for your dad in all its complicated ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think that my relationship with my father, you know, the thing about love, and this is, I don't think that there's anything more important to understand than the true nature of love and what it is and how you can live it. When I decided to turn toward as opposed to away from my father when he was in need, it opened up a door and a universe of understanding both ways. It's not just that I saw him more clearly. Like, I built deep empathy for him. I began to understand why he held on to the old world ways so much. He was a man who basically was forced to live in lifelong instability because he was born into civil war and never had a home. So what was he going to hold on to make himself feel like the world was stable? He needed that. I got it. And he looked at me in ways like he was shocked that his strongest confidant would end up being his youngest daughter and that we would have so much mutual respect for each other. But it happened because I turned toward him when he needed it as opposed to away. And man, the journey we had, I mean, like, you know, we took on the Department of Homeland Security together. We met over 1,000 immigrant families in New York going through what we went through. My father, who used to order me to go to the kitchen and cook, became the chef for the meetings that I held for other families like mine in this chapter of activism that I lived through in my life. I mean, like, how the tables turn when the heart is open, you know?
Well, let me go next to Tom in Castro Valley. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the comment that the part of the underlying problem and goes from prosecutors offering these two choices is that the court system is underfunded and it does not have the right to legalize itself to advocate for itself. So, for example, you all Forum has had the Supreme Court Justice for California, California Chief Justice on the program saying how unfunded it is. In California, the funds that were taken away from the court system during the Great Recession have never been given back, even before it was underfunded, whether we're talking about New York or California. So from any side, whether it's the prosecutor side, whether it's the defense side, whether it's the immigration side, whether you're conservative or liberal, there's not enough judges even there. And then if you go to the Family Self-Help Center in any given county, there's a line out the door and they can't see all the people that need the system.
You
it's
know,
a really big problem.
You know, the point that you're making, and I really I want to highlight to me how important, you know, this point is that you've got a criminal justice system that is broken in many ways. And thankfully, you know, today is very different from the 1990s. I think that there is a kind of awakening as to the many issues that we deal with in mass incarceration and institutionalized racism in the justice system, the underfunding, the distribution of power. There's so many issues there. And the other problem I'm trying to highlight through my memoir, through Here We Are, is that you've now based the entire immigration enforcement system on top of this already broken criminal justice system. So what happens when you build one system on top of an already broken system? You get a further broken system.
Well, let me go next to Judy in San Jose. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm calling because I want to take issue with a little comment that you just made, that the only reason she got to go to her fancy school is because she got a free ride.
Oh, no, I meant that the only way she could afford it.
That's right. Yeah.
Her family was very poor, and so the only way she was able to actually afford this school was because she was able to get a scholarship.
I think Mina was quoting me in my book even. but please, go ahead.
But you're clearly absolutely right. Arthi deserved to go. I mean, she showed a great deal of chutzpah.
Right. She deserved to go, and some schools and some institutions offer that financial assistance to people, and that's why I believe she That's certainly one of the big reasons why she is who she is today.
Yeah. Judy, thanks.
Thank you. And, you know, I feel like the experience of going to that school, I mean, I never had such a huge sort of exposure to, like, the elite, the creme de la creme of the U.S., like just how much wealth and power could exist in one place. But also my sense of identity as a strong and empowered girl and woman. I mean, I got the sense that girls rule the world from this school. It was awesome.
And also from your mom. I mean, even though this is a story about your dad and in many ways a tribute to him, as you say, you can really hear the real affection that you have for your mother. And you described her initially as, you know, just the most resilient person that you know. So how does your family feel about you telling this story? I mean, sharing so much of what frequently, you know, are things people try to keep hidden.
You know, I think, and it's actually interesting because in the process of talking about this book, I was asked by I was in a group of Indian Americans who were sort of leaders in politics and business. And they're like, Aarti, our community doesn't like to talk about these issues. Like, you know, for Indians, the stereotype is like the model minority stereotype. Oh, they're all doctors and lawyers. And you know what? That's so far from the truth. But sure, we'll take it. It works in our favor to be sort of overestimated in that way. So the question's like, how did you feel so comfortable talking about tough family things? I mean, I'm talking about a history of domestic abuse before America. I'm talking about, you know, I was undocumented as a child. I talk about that explicitly.
Right. You overstayed your tourist visa before you got green cards.
Yeah, and it's important to me that our listeners know that, oh, your Silicon Valley correspondent didn't have papers and grew up in a very working class undocumented family. That's who America is. And I'm an Indian American writing about prisons, not medical school. And I think that in part, I've been able to be honest and share a more untold part of the Asian American story because my family was isolated for so long in that case.
Well, it certainly is an honest memoir. It's called Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. And it's about NPR correspondent Aarti Shahani, who's based here in Silicon Valley. Thanks so much for coming in and talking about your book today.
Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. From all of us here at Forum, I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.